I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Welcome to The Connection. Terry Real has been a therapist for some 40 years and is founder of the Relational Life Institute. His latest book, Us, is about how we bring the unresolved family dramas from our childhood into our adulthood. And a few sentences caught my eye. He writes, "We all marry our unfinished business. We all marry our mothers and fathers. And in our closest relationships, we become our mothers and fathers. It's tough to maintain intimacy over a long period of time, especially when we're haunted by what has happened in the past, and we struggle to keep our heads above water." Terry Real is our guest today to help us address the toxic fallout from generational trauma, resolve the repetitive conflicts that can make us feel lonely and alone, and talk about why our winner-takes-all culture that prizes individuality is so harmful to building intimacy and human connection. He's the author of several other books, including I Don't Want to Talk About It, How Can I Get Through to You, The New Rules of Marriage. And Terry Real, nice to have you with us today on The Connection.
It's a pleasure, Marty. Thank you.
You're very welcome. Well, let's start with some of our founding documents, which really enshrine individual rights. We have a kind of mythology that we can pull ourselves up by our bootstraps. How has our history, our documents, even our mythology made it harder for us to connect psychologically?
You know, that myth of freestanding individualism, which is so American, is completely bullshit. We know from neurobiology, new research on neurobiology, that our very brains are social. We co-regulate all day long. Dan Siegel, who created interpersonal neurobiology, said social interaction is not a luxury for the brain. It's an essential nutrient. There is no such thing as self-regulation. We co-regulate. We are social animals. We are born to be relational. That's the ace I have in my pocket. But this whole culture, and the book Us is a critique of to what the father of family therapy, Gregory Bateson, great anthropologist, husband to Margaret Mead, said was our philosophical mistake as a species. That we stand apart from nature, that's individualism. That's what the word means.
Sure.
I stand. And two, that I can control it, that I should control it. And they're both nuts. And when we take that idea into our relationships, trying to control our bodies, I need to lose our minds, I need to be more, our marriages, our kids, our countries, other races. This dominant control model is delusional. And thinking that way leads us into adversarial contests with each other instead of working like a team. If I may just finish this overview thought.
Sure, sure.
The correction for the delusion of control and separation and dominance is what I call ecological wisdom. We're not apart from our marriages, families. We're in it. Our relationships are our biospheres. We breathe them. We're interdependent. And so when we wake up to the fact that we're in an ecological system, we shift from I win, you lose to what do we need to make this system work? And once we make that shift, everything changes.
Yeah, and I want to get to all of that because it's so important. I also have to say that when I typed the Lone Ranger, I was going to put that in my introduction. My spell check turned it into the Lonely Ranger, which I thought was kind of interesting, whether my computer was trying to tell me something.
That's incredible. Well, the cost of all of this are not. Look, we've never wanted more from our relationships than we do now. We have to understand history. Our grandparents, beyond a side-by-side companionable marriage, nobody drinks, beats anybody, fine. No, nowadays we want intimacy. We want to walk on the beach and have great sex. We want to be lifelong lovers, but we live in an anti-relational culture. It's not just individualistic. It's anti-relational, and yet we are trying to have this new ambition to be lifelong lovers in our marriages and long, within a culture that teaches us nothing about how to go about doing that.
You largely deal with couples, and I ran across a really interesting quote talking about how you approach your work, and you say you have to like action to manage marital combat. A therapist needs to get in there, mix it up with the client, be a ninja. This is intimidating, rather than being the either, I guess, the Freudian taking notes behind the person on the couch, or just being that empathetic voice that you have to get into the mix in order to what? Mix things up.
Yeah, we're very relational life therapy is the school I've created. We train this people, coaches, and therapists around the world. There are three phases. The first is loving confrontation. Marty, this is what you're doing to blow your foot off. For example, I'm not saying you're doing this. I'm
Right.
just
And
making.
it's a metaphor, I hope, but yes.
But I would say to someone, angry complaint will never invite your partner to be closer to you. You will never get closer to your partner by cratching about how distant they are. It's just not going to work. Or withdrawal or control. They're losing strength. So we name what you're doing that's getting in your way. That's one. Most therapy doesn't do that. We take sides. We're not neutral.
Right.
I would be happy to say to you, Marty, you're a nut. And Mr. Marty, I'll turn you into heterosexual marriage. Mr. Marty, you're an even bigger nut, and here's why. So we call it. Two, once I see what you're doing, the next question is, where did you get this from?
Right.
You were learning, you were adapting to something. It made sense back then. And we do deep trauma work in the couples therapy. We're unique in that. And then the third phase is once you've done enough trauma work that you're not flooded every time the heat's on, you can keep your wise adult, you stay centered. Then we teach you skills. Don't do it this way, do it this way. And I think it's the combination of confrontation. Let's look at what you're doing that will never work. Trauma work. Let's go back to that little girl that needed to fight, flight, fix. You needed to do that when you were little, but adaptive then, maladaptive now. And then three, don't do it this way. This is how you do it. I don't ask you what you think you should do. I assume you have no idea how to
Yes,
do
it's
it.
why I'm here, right? Well, let me ask you, and I put this in my introduction just because I thought it was provocative and important, and I think listeners as well, which is we marry our unfinished business. I guess unfinished being the operative word. We marry our mothers and fathers, and then we often become our mothers and fathers. Is it that we just have leftover things that we never resolved as kids that we're going to bring to whatever intimate adult relationship we have?
Yes, and we bring them in and we find somebody who's going to play with us out of hope to heal. People who won't recreate, we all think, oh, a great relationship, they don't get into it. No, I like to say it isn't what you do, it's what you do after you do what you do. We marry people who are going to throw us back in the soup, and that's a big disappointment. Now what? And the now what is, let me deal with what I learned as a kid so that I don't just automatically replay my defaults. Let me learn how to do something new. And then, if I do something new, God willing, you do something new. And that is healing. It's not that you're the mother I never got, it's when you're the same damn disappointing mother I had. If I, instead of having a fit or running away or whatever I learned to do as a kid, if I can take a breath, stay centered, and say, Marty, this is what you're doing right now. That doesn't work. As a favor to me, could you do this instead? And you do.
Then things change. And I do want to get to that as well. Let me just quote something that you write in the book, which really underscores what you just said. You write, falling in love means that whether you acknowledge it or not, you think, with this person, I will be healed. And at the very least, I will avoid and compensate for my earliest lacks and injuries. Then you go on to write, disillusionment comes with the cold realization that not only will your partner not directly heal you, but they are also exquisitely designed to stick the burning spear right into your eyeball. The idea is that we get these people into our lives, into our intimate lives, thinking they're going to fix us, and then they are there really to solve the problem we don't really want to solve.
Yeah, exactly. They throw us right into it. And what that is. You know, I'm famous for a few phrases, and one of them is normal marital hatred.
Right. I saw that.
All relationships are an endless dance of harmony, disharmony, and repair. Honeymoon, disillusionment, and then making peace. The skills come from moving from disharmony into repair, but we don't do that. We don't learn to. We don't even, as a culture, acknowledge that disrepair exists. A great relationship is all harmony. That's such crap. Listen, normal marital. I've been going around the world for 30 years talking about normal marital hatred. And not one person has ever come backstage and said, what do you mean by that? We wrap it up with each other. We pick people. There are people who you could be totally docile and placid with. They don't interest you. We're compelled by somebody who's going to throw us in. But also, unless we're very unlucky, someone who has other resources our parents didn't have. So that if we deal with the inner children in us and approach the person in a new way, they can respond in a way. And that is what heals us. Not them giving us what we didn't get, but our handling that crisis in a way that wasn't available to us as children. Can I tell you?
Well, you know what? Hold on. Let me just ask you a quick follow-up, and we also have a break coming up as well, because it makes me think that being in a long-term committed relationship is a kind of madness, that we've lost our minds thinking that we can make this work.
We can make it work. But,
I'd be happy.
You can be happy. You can be reasonably happy. But working means that you move through all of it. You move through harmony, disharmony, and repair. Trust comes from surviving all of it, not scooping. You know, we think a great relationship is all harmony. A great body is a 20-year-old's body. A great sex life is what you had in the first 2 weeks of your... No. Embrace your own humanity. Embrace all of it and learn how to navigate all of it. That's the richness of real intimacy.
Well, let's take that short break and then we'll get back to our conversation talking with Terry Real. He has written a number of books, including his most recent one, a bestseller called Us, Getting Past You and Me to Build a More Loving Relationship. He's also founder of the Relational Life Institute. And we are talking about some of the challenges and opportunities of long-term committed relationships. Do stay with us. We'll be right back.
These days, there's so much news, it can be hard to keep up with what it all means for you, your family, and your community. The Consider This podcast from NPR features our award-winning journalism. 6 days a week, we bring you a deep dive on a news story and provide the context and analysis that helps you make sense of the news. We get behind the headlines. We get to the truth. Listen to the Consider This podcast from NPR.
You're listening to The Connection here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoen, talking with longtime couples therapist Terry Real. He's an expert in dealing with generational trauma, founder of the Relational Life Institute, and author of a number of books, including Us, Getting Past You and Me to Build a More Loving Relationship. I do want to talk about trauma. You say trauma is relational. You have also disclosed your own childhood, your own upbringing, your own difficult father, who you describe as both loving but also violent. And I mean, I think it's so helpful when we hear from a therapist about what it is that they have struggled with to get to where they are. What was it like for you to grow up with a father who, as you said, was both violent but also loving?
confusing.
Yeah, I would think so.
Often is in these circumstances. It's a very common pattern in trauma. It's what I call empathic reversal. When he would lose it with me, I would feel sorry for him. It broke my heart, even while he was being violent, to see him. It was also a great riddle for me as a son. I grew up with the only model of male power was an abusive one. I should say a model of masculinity that is very much on the rise throughout the globe. There's been a resurgence of that. And I had to figure out what a healthy relationship to power was as a man. And I've spent about 60 years figuring that out.
So you had to unlearn some things that you had learned as a child about power and control?
Yeah, it's what the great Rian Eisler calls power with instead of power over. I knew that dominance and bullying was a recipe for loneliness and disaster. I wasn't, and as a young man, I tried to divest of power. A lot of young men these days have tried to do that, and nobody likes it. So what does healthy power look like for a guy? It looks the same for a guy as it does for a woman or a non-binary person. It looks like let me say this. Under patriarchy, which is the system we all live in, you can either be connected, accommodating, go with the flow, quote unquote, feminine, or you can be assertive, independent, masculine, but you can't be both at the same time. Think about that for a moment.
Sure,
You
very
can't
binary.
be at the same time because power breaks connection. And you see a lot of people, and therapists encourage it. I was weak, now I'm strong. Go screw yourself. No. I was weak, now I'm strong. This is what I want from you. What do you need to feel empowered to give it to me? Let's work together. That's a whole new world. And I call this loving power, speaking up for yourself, not as an individual, but as a team. This is what I want. What could I give you to help you give it to me? Who sounds like that?
Yeah.
And power, moving into both power and cherishing in the same breath. I have to teach everybody. No one knows how to do it. And it moves beyond the culture. There is no place in patriarchy for loving power. And I say this a lot. Moving men, women, non-binary folks into intimacy is synonymous with moving beyond the current culture and the world of patriarchy. Traditional gender roles will not lead to sustained intimacy. We
Yeah.
have to pioneers.
Yeah, no, I hear that. Another thing that you said was that it wasn't until you were in therapy with a therapist that you felt love. And you
Yes.
also write in this book that it's not until you were in your 60s where you felt basic trust,
Yeah,
which of course is a
that's true.
long time to not feel basic trust.
Yes, it is. I lived out of what we call the adaptive child part of me, which was self-protective and a fighter. I'm a blue-collar New Jersey Jew. Don't mess with me. And that's fine. I was protected. I wasn't so easy to live with. And the whole work of moving into intimacy means moving beyond what the adaptations that we made as children that worked to something less automatic, more thoughtful, and in our culture, something you really have to learn. Go to my website and take a course, go to a therapist and learn. I would like relational skills taught in elementary school, junior and high. We don't teach kids the basics, how to fight fair, how to stand up for yourself in a loving way, how to respond when your partner is upset with you. These are basic skills that we do not know in this culture. And yet we want Superb. I say we have a filet mignon ambition and hamburger skill.
Right, to be a carnivore about it, but at the same time, wanting intimacy, wanting closeness, not knowing how to ask for it, and thinking about just sort of the difficulty of finding the words, I think that people often don't really have in order to be able to create that environment.
Well, one of the skills I teach people is to shift from complaint to request, which is moving into vulnerability. There's nothing vulnerable about complaining. A lot of vulnerability to requesting. But the way we try and get more of what we want in our culture is we're spontaneous. We let the person do what they do. They fail us, and then we share with them our negative feelings about what a loser they are. That is the first modify. Look, there are three steps to getting what you want. One, lean in and be assertive. This is what I want. Pay attention is important. Two, once the person is listening, drop the aggression. Everybody gets that wrong, and help them out. Don't assume they know what you want. Teach them what you want. Listen, I just had a fight with a guy at work. My wife, Belinda, my wife, don't solve my problem for me. Give me 5 minutes of empathy. Just tell me what a rotten guy that is and what a wonderful person. Do that for, and then you can, great. More assertion up front, less resentment on the back end. So teach them. That's the second phase. And then the third is reward them. I teach people celebrate the glass 15% full. Hey, look, you did a lot better than you did last week. It still sucks, but we're not going to talk about that. What do you need to keep going? Let's keep going. So lean in and assert yourself in a loving way. Teach them what you want. Don't assume they know. And then make it worth their while to give it to you by rewarding them.
Does this, if not put an end to what you'd call as generational trauma, at least sort of lower the temperature on it, or give people the kind of skills to have a better psychological inheritance?
Yes, it's the height of presumption to quote yourself, but here's my four books, famous quote, if I may. Family pathology, family pathology, rolls from generation to generation, like a fire in the woods, taking down everything in its path until one person has the courage to turn and face the flames. That person brings peace to their ancestors and spares the children that follow. That's our work.
You know what? I want to play a clip from Good Will Hunting, and I know you know this clip. This is from the 1997 film Good Will Hunting. Therapist Dr. Sean McGuire, he's played by Robin Williams, is explaining to Will Hunting, who's played by Matt Damon, that the abuse he experienced in his childhood isn't his fault. This is about a minute.
It's not your fault. I know. It's not your fault.
All right.
It's not your fault. It's not your fault. Don't f with me. It's not your fault.
Don't f with me, all right? Don't f with me, Sean. Not you.
It's not your fault.
Tears in my eyes when I hear that scene. It's such a good movie, and it's such a good depiction of what good therapy looks like. But you see the therapist who has shared some things about himself, and you see Goodwill Hunting, as his name is, being sort of relieved, I guess, of the kind of guilt that he has felt. Maybe, as you said, you felt responsible when your father was violent with you.
Oh, Sean.
That Will Hunting is experiencing some of that, and hopefully relieving some of the pain.
Yes, what I spoke about with me and my dad, and what you're seeing here, is what I call empathic reversal. When you've been violated or used in some ways, Empathy, you have more than appropriate empathy for the perpetrator and less than appropriate empathy for yourself. You need to regulate that other person. And all good trauma work reverses that. So you start to have blood flowing between you and that little boy or little girl, and you start holding the perpetrator accountable. And yes, that's a moment. I will say this, though. You say that was great therapy. It was okay therapy.
Okay.
Great would be that moment with Will's wife, where he married, sitting next to him. And I believe it riles me as a relational therapist. 99% of all trauma work is done behind closed doors. I do it in the couple. There are some contraindications, but by and large. And man, does that open the heart of the person sitting next to you. Oh, I live with Will the fighter. Now I see why he had to fight, and I have compassion.
Let me just quickly reintroduce you. That's Terry Real, our guest today on The Connection. He's a therapist. In fact, has been a therapist for many decades now, founder of the Relational Life Institute. His most recent book is titled Us, Getting Past You and Me to Build a More Loving Relationship. So as you say, and I think we should all know this or certainly acknowledge this, that we had imperfect parents. If we are parents, we are imperfect parents doing that particular job. So you have two so-called damaged people who fall in love. They choose someone for a whole host of probably nutty reasons to be together. How do we decide, I guess, that that is the person that we want to be with? May, how much of it is conscious and how much of it is unconscious?
All unconscious. But
all unconscious.
I want to talk about how we work it. I can't let this go by without. Look, the problem is that when you're in the soup, when you're in disillusionment, A, our culture doesn't teach us the skills of how to get out of it, doesn't even acknowledge it. But B, we lose the best part of ourselves. When we're in the soup, by definition, we are being trauma triggered and we're flooded. And what we do is we react in an automatic way, you know, fight, flight, and now we've got a third fawn, fix. That's what we do. That's what we learn to do as kids. And we bring that adaptation, which we think of as an adult, but it's not. It's a kid's version of an adult, into our relationship. So I'm a fighter. My wife, Linda's a fighter. I get triggered. I fight. So the first skill is staying in the prefrontal cortex. What happens when we get trauma triggered is the most evolved part of our brain, prefrontal cortex, shuts down, literally, and subcortical, primitive parts of the brain, you know, fight, flight, or fix, bang, automatic. And that automatic response will produce the same drama over and over again. So the first skill is taking a breath, taking a walk, taking a time out, whatever you need, and I call it remembering love, getting out of that automatic move that you make over and over again into something more thoughtful, something that you've learned and cultivated that works better. Before you use any skills, you have to get into the part of you that wants to use skills to begin with. That's the first skill. And may I tell you a story?
Sure.
Yeah. Adaptive. So there's the prefrontal cortex, the thinking part of us, we call it the wise adult, the part I'm talking to now. Makes life dicey is there's a very primitive part of the brain that is the wounded child part of us, first moments of life, 4 or 5, just flooded, just all feeling. Between these two is the adaptation that most people think is their adult, but it's not. So here's the story. My specialty is couples on the brink that no one's been able to help. I have a couple. Why? Guy's a liar. It's not tenable. Lies about everything. You ask him what color his shoes are, he'll look down and say, they're not shoes, they're sneakers. I mean, you can't get it straight. And in fact, he's one of these guys, I walk in the office, I say, the sky's blue. He goes, well, it's not really blue. It's really... Between the report and watching how he moves, I got him. He's an evader. He's a champion evader. So I'm relational. He learned that adaptation in a relationship. Who was he evading? So I say to him, who tried to control you? Brilliant. If you're not, but once you start thinking relationally, there's somebody on the other end of that seesaw.
Sure.
Who are you? His father, military man, how he ate, how he sat. How did you deal with this controlling father? Ready? I lied. Dad said, don't play with Henry. I played with Henry, and I told him I played with John. Brilliant little boy. I have a saying, adaptive then, maladaptive now. You're not that girl. She's not your father. True story. They come back 2 weeks later, hand in hand. They're thrilled. I go, what happened? They go, we're done. Over the weekend, she sends him to the grocery store to get 12 things. True to form, he comes back with 11. She says, where's the pumpernickel? He says, I want the listeners to feel this. Every muscle and nerve in my body was screaming to say they were out of it, he said. And in this one moment.
Which would have been a lie.
In this one moment, I looked my wife in the eye. I took a breath. I thought of you, Terry. We therapists can lend our prefrontal. I thought of you. And I said to my wife, I forgot the damn pumpernickel. True story. She burst into tears. And she said, I've been waiting for this moment for 25 years. That's recovery. Moving out of the automatic adaptation you learned as a kid, taking a breath, and reaching for something more mature. That's how we get up.
And again, about a minute before our break here, one of the things you say is that when it comes to an argument, and couples often have the same argument, there might be different, might be about money, it might be about the children, it might be about whatever, the pumpernickel bread, but it's essentially the same argument. You say it doesn't really matter who's right and who's wrong. As a therapist, you say, I don't care. Why? In 30 seconds or less.
The relational answer to the question, who's right and who's wrong, is who cares. The real question is, how are we going to handle this in a way that works for both of us? She to him, you're a reckless driver. Him to her, you're nervous. One session with me. She to him, I get nervous driving with you. Maybe I'm crazy, but I do. As a favor to me, when I'm in the car, could you please slow down? Him to her, okay, I can do that. What could have been going on for 40 years is done in 15 minutes because it's subjective, not objective, it's humble, not arrogant, and it's an ask, not a demand. It's relational. She had to learn how to talk like that. And he like, yeah, but I don't want you to feel bad. I'm not a reckless driver, but well, that's learning how to talk.
We'll be right back. And our guest today on The Connection is Terry Real. And again, we are talking about relationships, long-term relationships. Stay with us. We'll be right back. You're listening to The Connection here on WHYY. In Philadelphia, I'm Marty Moss-Cohen, again talking with Terry Real. He's a couples therapist, founder of the Relational Life Institute, author of a number of books, including most recently, Us, Getting Past You and Me to Build a More Loving Relationship. Terry, you mentioned the fact that you deal with couples that are in what sounds like pretty deep trouble. They've had longstanding problems. But how do you know if a relationship is not just worth saving, but can be saved? And one that where you just realize, or the couple realizes, okay, we're done. We've gone about as far as we can go. It's time to say goodbye and move on with our lives.
It's very rare, actually, that both parties mutually agree that it's over. It's almost always one person and the other one's disappointed and wanting to. But if you go to my website, terryreal.com, I wrote an article, Rowing to Nowhere, When is Enough Enough, about how to decide whether to stay or go. And there's a tool I created, I call a relational reckoning, and it consists of a question. Here's the question. Am I getting enough in this relationship to make grieving what I'm not getting worth my while? Let me say it again. Am I getting enough here to make the pain of what I'm missing okay with me? You know, maybe our sex life isn't that great, or maybe he yells at the kids sometimes. Do I really want to die on this hill, or is it okay? And if the answer is, yeah, I don't love it, but it's okay. Feel the pain of it, but embrace what you get. Don't walk around like an angry victim. If the answer is no, it's not okay, then lean in and fight. And if you don't get anywhere, drag that person to a couples therapist. And forgive me, but my preference is you drag them to a relational life therapist because a lot of therapists aren't all that helpful. So drag them to a therapist who's really going to take your side and be your ally and help you get through to the person.
I mean, is it a kind of like a 55, 45, 60, 40 in terms of a calculation? And I can see how in a couple, one would feel one way and the other person would feel another way.
Well, yeah, I mean, quite often, this is why we take sides. We're not neutral, which is what therapy school to be. Quite often, one person is more dissatisfied because the other person is more difficult. They either don't give very much and or they're a pain in the neck to be around. They're irresponsible or unfaithful or God knows what. And we take that on. Yes, you're dissatisfied, and you, sir or madam, you better shape up, or these are the consequences you'll be facing.
I wonder too in a couple whether the so-called problem person in a couple, once you get to know them, you begin to see, as a therapist, you begin to see, oh, okay, maybe he's not the problem, but she's the instigator. I mean, it can look good from the outside, but once you dig in, you begin to see something else.
Yeah, you're not supposed to use this word anymore, but I started one of my books with a quote from my wife, Belinda, who's a very gifted therapist. And the quote is, "Beware of, quote, nice men, unquote, quote, bitchy wives, unquote. Those men are killers." And I have a saying, an angry woman is often a woman who doesn't feel heard. So it's not uncommon that I've got one person who really is, frankly, fairly insufferable to be with, but then I have the other one who's fed up and angry and not displaying their best behavior. The issue is that who they really are? Are they like that in every, or have they gotten warped trying to get through to somebody who's not easy to live with? Bring them in. And the proof is in the pudding. I take the side of the dissatisfied one.
Oh.
What you're asking for is right. The way you're asking for it sucks, but you're right. Let me teach you, other partner, how to be more pleasing to your partner. Once that person starts to change, then the other one's issues come to the surface. And people say to me, and I used to talk about men and women, but now I say the latent and the blatant. The unhappy one, their issues surface when the more difficult one starts to clean up and give them what they want. Then
Oh.
you see their issues because they rarely swoon in their arms and say thank you. Then they say, "Well, it's too little, too late," or some. And then, wow, what's going on with you? You're getting what you asked for.
As you said, beware of, and I'm quoting you, bitchy women and nice men. So what's the nice man? What is the nice man thing about? What is that about? I think we know about the bitchy women, and you say they don't feel heard. What's the defense, I guess, for being a nice man?
Marty, I don't know what your problem is. I'm sorry.
Oh, that's the nice man. Okay, I get it.
I
Right.
don't know. You seem to be laughing. Is this? I don't think this is funny, Marty.
Right. So it's there's a kind of passivity, a receptiveness,
Active
and
violation.
hostility.
There's active hostility, which at least has the bonus of being transparent. And then there's passive aggression, what you don't give. And in heterosexual relationships right now, a ton of women are lonely. A ton of women are insisting that men have more emotional vulnerability and connectedness than we raise boys to have. I write about this. The essence of traditional masculinity is invulnerability. The more, look at boys superhero. The more invulnerable you are, the more manly you are, the more vulnerable you are, the more girly you are, and that's not a good thing. Feminism have changed things for girls, but not for boys. And you know what? When you learn to shut off your feelings and go up into your head, to be independent and not depend on anybody, to do what you wanted and devil take the hunt. You learned all that stuff, whether you wanted to or not. When the imposition of traditional masculinity landed on you as a little boy, okay, all of those mores, by today's standards, guarantee you'll be seen as a lousy husband. So there aren't necessarily husbands who are out there cheating or drinking. They're just shut down. They just have no, they just, the women are lonely. And the response to empowered women's new demands for increased intimacy culturally has been a blowback. Now look around. If women would just go back to the 50s, all, no. I don't want women to stand down. I want men to stand up and learn a few relational skills. It's good for you. It's good for your health. It's good for your children. What women are asking for is legit. Stand up and let me teach you how to meet them.
I understand that. I understand what you're saying. And I think, you know, there's lots of data, I think, to underscore the fact that it seems that boys and men are struggling these days. But I also feel, and this is more anecdotally, as I see young men that I work with here at WHYY or young men in my life, and I see them being more relational, more emotional, more raising children, you know, more the kinds of things that you say that men should be.
Some
or,
are, some
or
are.
Could be.
Some are, some aren't. It has a lot to do with whether you're red or blue. It has a lot to do with where you are geographically in this country. There are, I, 10 years ago, I wrote the most gender progressive generation in the world are young men. That's changed. There's that. And then there's also the manosphere. It's a we're in conflict right now.
You just said something interesting about red and blue. I mean, do you see this as political?
Absolutely, 100%.
Meaning?
100%.
Meaning?
Look, you know, it's couched as anti-woke or whatever, but it's really anti-feminist. And there's been an enormous blowback and a resurgence of traditional masculine dominance, no matter what body you're in, could be a woman, but a resurgence of some of the nastiest elements of traditional masculinity and patriarchy with a vengeance, with glee. And it's a direct response to boys and men feeling they've been shamed, they've been told that they're wrong, which has some truth in it, too. But the answer is not to go back and flex your muscles and be a dominant bully. The answer is to step up and keep your strength, but cure it in the heat of intimacy, compassion. I want strong, big-hearted men. This is not a binary. You can be big-hearted and strong at the same breath. Women do it. This is a phony polarity. Men can be plenty strong and also sensitive and compassionate and receptive all at the same time.
You have written about shame and grandiosity as being sort of the two self-esteem disorders that we I guess know about, with the focus largely on shame. You say we really need to focus more on grandiosity. I think that's what you're saying here, this sense of feeling entitled and superior and how that gets people into trouble.
Yeah. Anybody been reading the papers lately? I mean, on the planet Mars here? Yes. And of course, now everybody's interested in my work on grandiosity, particularly men. I wonder why. Listen, the resurgence of the old dominant, superior, contemptuous, I'm in control model which is being celebrated, not just in our country, but globally right now, is, I think, is the death throes of an old model. In reality, we live in an interdependent world. We live in an ecological system. Wake up. We have to learn to cooperate and take care of the biosphere we live in, or the old model of I'll do whatever the hell I want, and that's what power and masculinity looks like, is literally suicidal at this point on a planetary level. We will wake up to the reality of relationship and interdependence, or we may not have a planet to grandchildren. Look, it is in my interest to keep our ecological system healthy, because I have these big burly guys who say, why should I work so hard to please my wife? And I go, knock, knock, you live with her. wake up. You're not the Lone Ranger. You're in a context. It's in your enlightened self-interest to take care of that context.
Well, as you mentioned, a couple creates its own biosphere, right? I mean, we live in this, you know, gigantic biosphere called the Earth, but that a couple creates their own mini biosphere.
Yes, and I talk about, it's not one wins and the other loses. If one loses, look, thinking ecologically, if I win and you lose, guess what? We both lose. Why? Not idealism. The loser makes the winner pay for it. Count on it. It's in my interest that we're both happy because we live together. I can choose to pollute my biosphere with a temper tantrum or withdrawal, but I'll breathe in that pollution with your withdrawal or your temper tantrum. I can't escape you. We're linked. Wake up to the wisdom of understanding that we are linked in a context, and then take care of the context for your sake. It's not about one of you winning and the other one losing.
You talk about something called the relational golden rule, and I'll quote you here, where you ask, what do you need from me to help you come through for me? Which I think is this kind of biosphere idea.
Exactly. I would like you to be less critical. Okay, I'll work on that. Can I do anything to help you be less critical? Actually, yeah, you can appreciate my efforts rather than being critical yourself about how critical I am. You can do for me what you're asking of. Yeah, I guess I have been pretty critical, haven't I? Yeah. Okay, thank you. Let me start now. Thanks for saying you'll work on it. That's nice to hear. We're a team. What do you, you know what? Dysfunctional moves disempower your partner. Use your head. Dysfunctional moves in a car stop it from moving. Dysfunctional moves in a marriage render your partner helpless. I hate what you did, and I hate what you did 2 weeks ago, and you are, and you always, I'm just pounding you into the ground. Hey, Marty, here's what would work for me. You're doing great. This would be even better. Can I help you do that? Which of those two moves do you think is going to get me what I want?
Sure, sure. But and I'm looking at the clock, but I'm also feeling kind of defensive, which I think we often do in a conflict, in an argument. How do you, is it the other person that makes us feel less defensive, how they approach us?
No, we have to, we have to take charge of our reactivity, no matter what. If Belinda's being nice to me and I'm
your
nice
wife,
back,
yeah,
easy pickings. If Belinda's in her adaptive child and she's fighting and nuts, and I take a breath and I don't jump in the mud pit with her and get into my five-year-old fighter, but stay in my wise adult, not a great day for her, a okay day for us, a wonderful day for me. How I handle myself is not up to you to determine. The relationship is not one in which you give me everything I want. The relationship is an opportunity for me to work on myself.
Oh. So the sort of ongoing work that I guess we all have to do on ourselves in our long-term relationships, right?
What a gift. What a gift.
Right, exactly. What a gift. Well, Terry Real, thank you so much for joining us today on The Connection.
Thank you. It's been a delightful talk.
Thank you so much. And again, he's a longtime therapist, has been working for something like 40 years, founder of the Relational Life Institute, the author of a number of books, including a bestseller titled Us and its subtitle Getting Past You and Me to Build a More Loving Relationship. Other books include I Don't Want to Talk About It, How Can I Get Through to You, and The New Rules of Marriage. Diana Martinez, the engineer for today's edition of The Connection. The show is produced by Debbie Builder with Paige Murray Bessler. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Thank you so much for joining us.